Well, good afternoon, and welcome to today's program, America's Path to Permanent War, with author and professor of international studies at Boston University, Andrew Bacevich. My name is Ralph Kuiper, and I'm a trustee of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the chairperson for the Peninsula Chapter, which you're invited to come and attend our events. The World Affairs Council provides a forum where leading authorities can inform and involve the public in matters of national and international concern. And you can learn more about the council by going to the website www.itsyourworld.org. If you are unable to attend a program, there are two excellent ways to stay connected. You may listen to our weekly radio broadcast, which is It's Your World, on Monday evenings at 8 p.m. on KQED. And on our website, you can find audio and video archive of our past programs. Please take a moment to turn off your cell phones and other audio devices that might interrupt the program. And while you're doing that, I will mention an upcoming program that may be of interest to you. This Tuesday, August 17th, the Council is pleased to co-host Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus to discuss the Navy's energy infrastructure. Secretary Mabus will explore how the Department of the Navy is moving towards a more energy-efficient fleet and away from a dependency on foreign fossil fuels. This event will take place at the Marines Memorial Theater at 11:30 a.m. Again, that's August 17th. Finally, blue question cards were placed on your chairs. Please write your questions and hand them to council staff members who will be located throughout the room. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest. Andrew Bacevich is a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy and retired as a colonel from the U.S. Army. He received his Ph.D. in American Diplomatic History from Princeton University. Before joining the faculty of Boston University in 1998, he taught at West Point and at Johns Hopkins University. His essays and reviews have appeared in a wide variety of notable publications, including Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, The Nation, and The New Republic. He writes op-eds for The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, among other newspapers. In 2004, Dr. Bacevich was a Berlin Prize Fellow at the American Academy in Berlin. He has also been a fellow of the Paul H. Nitze School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and the Council on Foreign Relations. Today, he will discuss his latest book, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Please join me in welcoming Andrew Bacevich.
Well, I'm not sure how it is that in the middle of August in San Francisco, California, you have nothing better to do than to come hear someone like me talk. But I'm deeply grateful that you have chosen to make that decision. It's very flattering for me to be able to speak to you today. I'm in the middle of about a three-week-long soiree trying to get people to notice the publication of this book. I'm at the point where my blazer is starting to look a little bit bedraggled, but we will forge on. What I'd like to do is to speak fairly briefly, I think probably not more than about 18 or 20 minutes. And my purpose will be to briefly summarize the argument that's presented in the book, to try to do it in a way that I'll provide a sufficient amount of information that you'll actually be interested in the book, but not so much information that you'll say, well, okay, I got that, let's move on to the next thing. Let me begin with a couple of questions. And the first, I think, on the minds of a lot of us today, why are we in Afghanistan? Second, maybe not so much on our minds today, but sort of carried as part of the baggage for at least some members of my generation, why were we in Vietnam? Two questions about two wars, 40 years or so apart from one another. But I think really those two questions really can be answered with one single answer. We are in Afghanistan, we were in Vietnam, because Washington stubbornly adheres to a national security consensus, a pattern of behavior that no longer works. And the book tries to describe this national security consensus, tries to explain where it came from, tries to make the case that it doesn't work, offers some thoughts about why it persists anyway, and then concludes by trying to offer some alternative, if only to make the case that alternatives do exist to the status quo. The national security consensus consists of two main elements. The first element really asserts a claim about what the United States is called upon to do in the world. I call this the American Credo. And the American Credo asserts that the United States, and we should emphasize the United States alone, has a responsibility, an obligation to lead, shape, save, liberate, and transform the world. The second component of the Washington rules I call the Sacred Trinity. And the Sacred Trinity relates more specifically to our understanding of military power and its application in pursuit of the American Credo. And the Sacred Trinity, being a Trinity, consists of three elements. And the first of those elements is the assertion that the United States, and again we should emphasize the United States alone, needs to maintain a global, emphasize, global military presence. The second element of the Sacred Trinity says that the United States ought to configure its forces not primarily to defend America, but rather than to make available instruments of global power projection. And then the third and the last element of the Sacred Trinity is one that says, well, we should marry this global military presence to these global power projection capabilities to support a pattern of global interventionism. Together, Credo and Trinity constitute the way that Washington attempts to govern and police the American century. The Trinity lends plausibility to the Credo's vast claims. The Credo justifies the Trinity's vast requirements and vast exertions. Now you will have noted that I'm employing some sort of religiously charged language in describing the national security consensus, in describing the Washington rules. And I do that for two reasons. The first reason, of course, is because I'm a conservative Catholic, and we conservative Catholics never cease to attempt to bring all the fallen back to Rome, so this is sort of my way to do that. More seriously, the reason for using the religiously charged language is to make the point that there really is no empirical evidence to support the claims made in the American Credo, and not a lot of empirical evidence to suggest that the practices inherent in the Sacred Trinity actually work all that well. And the fact that both Credo and Trinity persists is to a great degree a matter of faith. Together, the Credo and the Trinity define the rules to which Washington adheres. And they determine the precepts by which Washington attempts to rule. Yet there is a problem. And the problem is that the Washington rules don't work. At least they don't work any longer. Indeed, blind adherence to the Washington rules is proving to be counterproductive, a point that I would say is manifestly the case ever since 9/11. Promising American safety and security and prosperity, the Washington rules have produced something akin to permanent war. Promising to preserve the American way of life, the Washington rules have set the United States on a course towards bankruptcy, both fiscal and, at least as important, moral. So what should replace the Washington rules? Well, I think I would offer for people's consideration an alternative credo. My own credo would be one that would revive the conviction that America's purpose, America's primary obligation, is to be America. That our, what we are really called upon to do is to fulfill the aspirations expressed in the founding documents, such as the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. And in that regard, I would point to the concluding phrase in the preamble of the Constitution in particular, which states that the purpose of our union is to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity. And in that clause, the key word, I think, has to do with posterity. And securing, with regard to securing the blessings of liberty to ourselves, meaning to the present generation and to future generations, it seems to me that there is one heck of a lot of work still to be done. I talk a couple times in the course of the book about perhaps saving Iraq and Afghanistan ought to take a back seat to fixing Cleveland and Detroit. Now, lest this sound like a call to, you know, pulling up the drawbridges and retreating inside Fortress America and turning our backs on the entire rest of the world, let me make the following case with regard to this alternative credo. If in the course of fulfilling, living up to our ideals, the United States should be able to serve as an exemplar to others, that in manifesting the value of liberal values, if other people in other nations should find something that they can themselves adopt, then I would say that's all to the good. Although I would also want to insist that we should not confuse a side benefit for our primary obligation or purpose. Now, when it comes to military power, military forces, I'd suggest an alternative trinity as well. From my point of view, the first element of that trinity should be one that defines the primary duty station of the American soldier as America. And I'm perfectly willing to grant that there inevitably will be circumstances that will call upon us to deploy American soldiers to other parts of the world at certain times to accomplish certain purposes. But I'm trying to suggest that the notion that we should deploy U.S. forces around the world in perpetuity, which is the case, makes no sense and is counterproductive. The second element of my alternative trinity would be one that says that we should design U.S. forces not for global power projection, but to defend the United States in its most vital interests. And here, too, let me note that the addition of that phrase referring to vital interests potentially opens up a great big door. We have seen in our own time the willingness of people to define vital interests in such an elastic way that it includes basically anything. I mean, I'm sort of waiting for the announcement to come from the White House that the United States has a vital interest in Yemen, you know, and we have to go invade Yemen next. And I'm willing to admit the possibility that the phrase vital interest can be abused, because I believe that our democratic politics, among other things, should enable us to have a debate about what constitutes vital interests. And out of that democratic debate can come some reasoned conclusions that recognizes the vital interests that really are vital and is able to distinguish between those that are peripheral. And finally, my third element of the alternative trinity would be one that would assert that we ought to use force consistent with the just war tradition. Many of you know that the just war tradition really emerged out of an effort in a traditional Christianity to provide guidelines to discern when the use of force can be morally justified, and also to discern when the use of force is being done in a way that would qualify as moral. My conviction is that the just war tradition is useful not simply for moral thinking, but also for pragmatic thinking. And then, according to the just war tradition, force should be employed only as a last resort and only in self-defense. And even then, I would insist that in using force, we recognize that violence has quite limited, not non-existent, but quite limited utility as an instrument of statecraft. And even in those circumstances, the costs and consequences are probably going to end up being larger than people anticipate on day one of the conflict. How likely is it that we will see any departure from the Washington rules? How likely is it that we will see any serious willingness in Washington to consider an alternative credo and an alternative trinity? Not likely. Why is that? Two reasons, I think. Reasons, and I'll close on this note and then look forward to the discussion. The first reason is that despite the fact that the Washington rules don't work, Washington itself remains deeply invested in the national security status quo. That status quo is not making us safer, is not ensuring our continued prosperity and well-being, but the Washington rules do deliver very formidable substantive goods to Washington itself. The Washington rules provides profit to the military-industrial complex. The Washington rules enable the component parts of the national security state to justify their budgets and to justify their prerogatives. The Washington rules enable ambitious people, be they high-ranking civilian officials or high-ranking generals, to exercise great authority and to fancy that they occupy some important seat in the making of history. The Washington rules, this penchant for a militarized policy, I think even in many respects pervades the mainstream media. Nobody gets more excited. Nobody gets a bigger charge out of the prospect of going to war than do the reporters who want to go cover what they view as a big story. So to expect that any challenge to the Washington rules is going to come from Washington is, I think, a fairly idle thought. But there is a second reason, I think, why the Washington rules are unlikely to face any serious challenge, and the second really kind of comes closer to us. And that is that having been conditioned for so long to believe that there really is no alternative to the Credo and the Trinity, we ourselves have tended to become, in my view, excessively deferential to Washington with regard to the content of national security policy. We have, as a people, in many respects, forfeited the ability to ask first-order critical questions about why we are in Afghanistan or why we were in Vietnam. And until we can recover that capacity to ask those first-order questions, and Washington is going to continue to get its way, and there won't be any serious change. So with that, I'll stop, and I very much look forward to any questions or comments that you may have. Thank you very much.
Well, there are no shortage of questions. Or opinions. Today's New York Times, this was the first question we had, and I thought this would allow you to expand a little bit. Today's New York Times reports that our military is asking for more time for its Afghan mission. A senior official uses the word decades. Is Afghanistan our 21st century South Korea? I might add to that, I think I heard something similar to that from an Iraqi officer this morning, saying that we needed to stay there until 2020, I think, was his date. So, do you have any comments on that?
I got up this morning in Portland at 4:15. Only could briefly glance at the papers on the computer before I headed to the airport, but noted that very interesting article. And a couple of responses. One, not necessarily, I think, implicit in the way you framed the question. As I recall, the text of the article said that General Petraeus, who has been relatively silent for the last 6 weeks or so since he took command, is about to launch on a media offensive. I think that was the phrase in the article. A media offensive in order to lead the charge in this effort to gain more time for the counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan to work. One of my sort of abiding interests is civil-military relations, and one of my real concerns is the extent to which substantive civilian control actually exists in Washington. So I read something like that, and I have to tell you, the alarm bells start going off. Why is it that a theater commander takes it upon himself to launch a media offensive? And what business is it of the commander to influence through his own actions this issue of how much time the commander-in-chief wishes to allow to this mission? Now, the commander-in-chief has put himself in a real pickle, because the commander-in-chief announced in December 2009 that he was going to buy into this escalation of the war, and an escalation of the war that basically embraced this notion of counterinsurgency. And then for, I think, mostly domestic political reasons, the commander-in-chief simultaneously said, and oh, by the way, by July of 2011, we will begin to withdraw U.S. forces. A lot of people said at that very moment, it ain't going to work, because the military officers arguing for a decade, we would actually should say a second decade in Afghanistan, probably are more or less right. Not that anybody can forecast how much time it would take to bring an operation like this to conclusion, a successful conclusion, even if success is possible. But to the extent that the aim in Afghanistan, and I think I'm not being unfair here, that the aim in Afghanistan is to create effective national Afghan institutions, political and military and security and so on. The work is not going to be done by July of 2011. My own view would be that one of the reasons the generals or other officers making this pitch should be told to button their lips is that their argument presumes that Afghanistan really is a vital interest of the United States, to go back and use the language I used in the talk. The presumption seems to be that if we can prevail in Afghanistan, if we can pacify the country, if we can build a nation, the assumption seems to be that we will have made some enormous gain relative to the threat posed by violent anti-Western jihadism. And it seems to me, if you think about that for about 3 seconds, you know that that's baloney. If General Petraeus tomorrow could wave his magic wand and Afghanistan would become a stable liberal democracy, the threat, however dangerous you evaluate the threat, and that's a good argument to have, the threat posed by violent anti-Western jihadism would not be significantly reduced. Because that threat is not particularly situated or headquartered or originating in Afghanistan. The problem is a transnational one. So these guys want to keep fighting on another year so they can complete their mission in Afghanistan. In a sense, it's very commendable that they feel that sense of commitment to that mission. But strategically, it doesn't make any sense. And it certainly doesn't make any sense for us to allow military officers, regardless of how well-intentioned they are, to play that sort of policy-making role, especially when it's likely to bring them into conflict with the civilian who is supposed to be in charge of everything. Is that a fair answer?
Okay. I'm going to press you a little bit more on this one, though. There's another element to the Afghanistan presence, and this question raises the issue of regional concerns, and particularly with Afghanistan, we have Pakistan next door, which has nuclear weapons, and so would this constitute some more rational reason for remaining in Afghanistan longer than what might make sense otherwise?
You know, were we to have a debate about what are the things that would fall under the list of vital interests and what are the things that don't qualify, the question of Pakistan would make for an interesting discussion. And I personally would say that the fate of Pakistan probably does qualify as a vital interest. And to say that it qualifies as a vital interest actually does not necessarily imply that we have it in our capacity to determine the future of Pakistan, which, quite frankly, I don't think we do. But to get to the point, really, which is the point of what is the relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and how might that relationship, therefore, affect our thinking about what to do in Afghanistan? Well, if you can make the case to me that perpetuating the American or Western war in Afghanistan has been contributing and will continue to contribute to stability in Pakistan, then maybe you could persuade me to continue the Afghan war. But you're going to have a real hard time making that case. We have been in Afghanistan for 9 years now. It is the longest war in our history. Over the course of those 9 years, has Pakistan become more stable or less stable? I mean, the question answers itself. I can't stand here and absolutely prove to you that there is a causal relationship between American military or Western military activities in Afghanistan and this growing instability. But by golly, it sure looks that way. So it's hard for me to understand how the very real concerns we have about the future of Pakistan, and the nuclear issue is part of that. It's very difficult for me to see how those real concerns can then translate into an argument for staying the course in the war.
There are a number of questions that relate to potential influences on the thesis and the theme that you're mentioning, including economic impact. Our country and the world, for that matter, is having a very difficult time now with our economy. There are other pressures coming from political entities, nations that look to us for support. The Middle East with Israel is a potential example of that. There are issues about resources, oil, for example, the political and economic ramifications of our attaining the peak oil in the global production. And I think similarly with other resources, we see China, for example, expanding their sphere of influence by negotiating with other countries for resource contracts. So that's a pretty broad question, but how do you see these factors playing into your thesis?
That's a hell of a question. How does economic crisis, Israel, oil, and China affect everything?
The main thing is there are outside forces that.
Let me take a step. First on economics. When the Washington rules were forged in the wake of World War II, I can make an argument that they kind of sort of made sense. That in the late 1940s, beginning of the Cold War, this especially rich and creative moment in American statecraft, Truman Doctrine, Marshall Plan, creation of NATO, that those actions did, in fact, contribute to our safety, security, and well-being. That they did so reflected a particular set of conditions that existed at that time. I mean, I'm not going to tell you anything that you don't already know, but it does seem to me that these are some things that we need to remind ourselves of. World War II had basically depleted the ranks of great powers, leaving only two, the United States and the Soviet Union. And even the Soviet Union had been severely battered as a consequence of the war. We alone came out of the war stronger as a result of that conflict. It's one of the reasons I think we tend to have a somewhat distorted view of that chapter in world history, because in an odd way, and I certainly don't mean to cause offense to anybody who may have lost a loved one in that war, but in a very odd way, World War II was a good news story for America. You know the per capita GDP doubled during World War II in this country? So we came out of the war with all the money, with all the marbles. We came out of the war, and our allies, other liberal democracies, countries that were important to us, really needed our protection and our assistance. And we possessed the resources to provide that assistance, and a generation of statesmen like General Marshall and Secretary Acheson recognized the importance of doing so. My point here is that world does not exist any longer. We don't have the money, and we no longer make the stuff. We insist on continuing to buy the stuff, most of which these days comes from places like China, and even though we can't pay for it, we insist on buying it anyway, which means we're going deeper and deeper into debt. And this fundamental change, it seems to me, in our economic position in the world very much needs to factor into our strategic thinking, our thinking about the role that we're going to play in the world. We have to learn to live within our means. Or posterity, back to the preamble of the Constitution, posterity is going to curse us because of the burdens we will be imposing on future generations. Therefore, we need to accept the limits of our power, the limits of our reach, and I think that all of that simply reinforces my argument about the Washington rules having outlived their usefulness and needing to be replaced. And the question of Israel is a very difficult one. I mean, I don't think there's any question about, I hope there's no question about Israel's right to exist. There should be, in my mind, no question about a deep-seated moral responsibility that we in the West, we in what used to be called Christendom, have with regard to the survival of the Jewish state. Because there is a long history. I don't need to recite the history. You know the history of anti-Semitism leading up to the Holocaust and so on. That said, our obligation to the state of Israel cannot extend to the point where the government of Israel acts in ways that are fundamentally at odds with our own well-being. And I think it's becoming increasingly evident that the government of Israel does act in ways contrary to our interests. Whether the issue is one of Israel's nuclear arsenal, whether it is the question of the support for the continuing growth of settlements in the occupied territories. And there does come a time, it seems to me, where it becomes necessary for us to say to the government of Israel, you guys need to do whatever you think it is necessary to advance the safety and well-being of your country, but you can't expect us simply to blindly defer to your preferences. And I think we're beginning to get to that point. That doesn't imply abandoning Israel. I mean, Israel is far and away the most powerful country in that part of the world. But it may mean a fairly sharp break in terms of diplomatic relationships. On the question of oil, it was frequently said by critics of the Iraq war back when the George W. Bush administration was, you know, ramping up to invade Iraq. Well, this is just war for oil. This is just George W. Bush, an oil man, and his vice president, former president of a major oil services firm, concocting a totally unnecessary war just so they can deliver profits to all their oil buddies. And that was probably unfair to the Bush administration, and yet, of course, is not entirely devoid of truth. Because the truth is that the American way of life has long since become dependent upon the availability of abundant and relatively cheap fuel. Although I can't believe the price of gas you guys pay around here. But we need to acknowledge the extent to which our common understanding of what it is to live in freedom is connected to the availability of mobility. And let me point the finger right here. I mean, here I am in San Francisco in the past week, having been to Portland and Seattle and Washington and New York, and looking forward to going to Denver and Boulder and Minneapolis and Chicago before, please God, I get to go home to Boston again. And I take it for granted that I can just get on an airplane and go wherever I want to go to, you know, pursue my personal interests. And I'm reluctant to acknowledge what we all need to begin to confront, and that is there may be some tension between the exercise of freedom defined in that way and other urgent needs of the country, not least of all learning to live within our means and finding some ways of returning to a more sensible national security policy. The Iraq War may not have been, in a strict sense, a war for oil, but it's certainly true that the larger pattern of American involvement in part of that part of the world simply would not have happened were it not for the fact that that's where the majority of the world's oil reserves are located. If it weren't for oil, we wouldn't care any more about Iraq than we care about Paraguay. And I think it's not only a cause of dysfunction in our policy, but embedded in are some troubling moral questions. With regard to China, I think proponents of the Washington rules, people who believe in the American credo and who believe in global military presence and power projection capabilities and interventionism, tend to be people who argue that the national security consensus needs to be sustained in part because of the belief that lurking just over the horizon is some great conflict with China. And in essence, we need to, you know, gird our loins to be ready for this thing. I myself think that that's, if that sort of thinking may well lead to a self-fulfilling prophecy, but not a necessary one. I am not a China expert. I've only been to China once. I found it a enlightening and dazzling experience in many respects. But from what I know of China, I know nothing of China that suggests that China's aspirations extend to the point that they want to see the entire world live according to Chinese values. And that absent the universalization of Chinese values, that they will feel unsafe and vulnerable. That's actually the way we think. You know, we think that our values are universal values and that our values should prevail in China and in Afghanistan and in Iraq and sort of on the margins, even Paraguay. And we are the ones who feel uneasy that there will be major quarters of the world in which there is some potential to the exercise power where American values don't prevail. So it doesn't seem to me that there's anything that will guarantee that somehow that mandates that we're going to be on this great collision course with China. What China wants as a great power certainly has to be one of the great questions of the 21st century. And I guess we'll find out. My own sense is that what China wants is A, to get rich, and B, to command respect, and C, probably to more or less call the shots in its own neighborhood. Now, if you're Vietnamese, that last item might be a bit troubling. If you live in the United States of America, it's not clear to me why it has to be all that troubling. I mean, we tend to insist that we call the shots in our own neighborhood. So I think that the China-U.S. relationship ought to be manageable. It's not going to be without a certain amount of friction and competition, but I don't see why we have to look forward to the 21st century becoming sort of a mirror of the last half of the 20th century, when the competition between the United States and the Soviet Union was kind of the defining feature of international politics.
I have a lot of questions that have a theme to them also, and I think they're sympathetic to the ideas that you're expressing in your book, but they're concerned that they won't find a fertile ground in the American public. In other words, it may be hard to convince the average citizen that it is not in our interest to have defensive forces deployed in bases overseas, for example. They have been persuaded that that is in our national defense interest. So it's sort of a broad question, but is there something in our psyche that might have to be addressed in order to persuade people that there's an alternative to these credos and trinities?
Well, I hope it was clear from my presentation that I'm not exactly optimistic that all this is going to have a happy ending. I'm actually not very optimistic. I offer some thoughts in the book about what alternative course we could pursue, but I don't think I have any illusions about the likelihood of real change. And in part it's because, yes, we have been conditioned to accept it as uncontroversial that 60 years after the end of World War II, there are still U.S. forces in Germany. Why? Germany can't defend itself? Who does Germany have to defend itself from? So we've come to accept these things as simply the way things are. Can't ask the critical questions. I also am, as somebody who has two, not one, but two unemployed daughters, I'm also, one of whom has a job interview today, I'm also acutely conscious of the fact, and I mean this quite seriously, life is tough. You know, putting three squares a day on the table, raising your kids in our society, dealing with the routine tragedies of life, illness, substance abuse problems, you name it. So to some degree, the American people, I think, accept things that should not be accepted because, by golly, it's just tough to make it out there, and we need to empathize with our fellow citizens in that regard. Somebody, a young woman, came up to me the other night at a book talk, and she said, "Who comes to your talks?" And I looked at the audience then, as I'm looking at you right now, and I said, "The people who come to my talks are people like me." Meaning, they are people, what I mean by that is people more or less of my age, and frankly, probably more or less of my station in life, in the sense that I'm doing okay. I'm not engaged in a day-to-day struggle. Lots of people are engaged in a day-to-day struggle. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm a bit pessimistic. Now, let me give you the little glimmer of optimism, just so you can go away with a smile on your face, or at least not think I'm totally Mr. Gloom and Doom. I've noticed lately that I'm getting an increasing number of emails from serving military officers. I don't want to tell you it's a scientific sample. It's not. But pretty steady flow of things from captains and majors and colonels that say, "I've read one of your books, I saw your op-ed, I saw you quoted," and they say either, "Gosh, I agree with you, I think you're onto something," or they might say, "You know, I wonder if you could expand and answer this question and answer that question." And the optimism I have is that suggests to me that there is bubbling in the officer corps an awareness that this ain't working. And were that idea to catch hold in the officer corps. I think that could really be end up being a powerful source for change. You know, if instead of having General Petraeus and the people around him talking to reporters for the New York Times saying, yeah, we need 10 more years in Afghanistan, officers started to say, maybe this isn't in the Army's interest or the country's interest. That might open the door for debate. And lest I sound like I'm contradicting myself, I don't mean that we need to have the officer corps become a lobby promoting change. But I do think a rethinking from within the officer corps might help encourage thinking in the educated public and perhaps even among our political leaders.
There was one specific question back to Afghanistan again about whether you might have had some very specific recommendations for what Obama should have done after his several months long consideration.
Well, I do understand that I myself am preoccupied with Afghanistan, and I recognize the extent to which there is this preoccupation with Afghanistan. I have to keep telling myself that Afghanistan actually is not the core question. That Afghanistan is an ongoing war. It is a war in which we are pouring tens of billions of dollars, and in which we are losing many American soldiers, and in which, to some degree, we're wreaking a certain havoc on the Afghan people. So it's a trivial question. It's simply not the most important question. The most important question, and here I'm going to repeat myself a little bit, is what's the appropriate response to the threat posed by violent Islamic jihadism? And it's not occupying countries in order to try to change them. So to my mind, when the president went through this prolonged period of analysis and reconsideration during calendar year 2009, instead of focusing on the question, what should I do about Afghanistan, he should have focused on the question, what should be our strategy in dealing with this problem? And after he came up with that strategy, then he should have said, okay, if that's our strategy, now I do have this ongoing conflict on in Afghanistan, how does it fit in relation to that revised strategy? My own revised strategy would have been one that would have said, realistically evaluate the threat. It's not Nazi Germany. It can be dealt with through means other than waging protracted war. Focus on those means, and quite frankly, the perpetuation of the Afghanistan war in that context is irrelevant and counterproductive, and we should shut it down. Now, people say, in particular, for example, recently after that horrific cover photograph on Time magazine with that poor young Afghan woman who'd been mutilated by the Taliban, people say, but given that we're there, don't we have a moral obligation to the Afghan people? I mean, can you simply pull out? And I think that's a serious question, but it's a question that deserves a serious and considered and thoughtful response. And I think the serious, thoughtful response is not one that sort of reflexively says that the most effective way to meet a moral obligation is to continue an ill-advised war. I myself would pose, I think, at least three questions. To the extent that the United States has moral obligations to other people, why do the Afghan people come first? I mean, I've argued that we actually have a heck of a lot more. We have a deeper and more pressing obligation to the people of Mexico. And I say that because they've been our neighbors now we're coming up toward the bicentennial of the Mexican Republic. Most of that 200 years, we actually haven't sort of been kind and gentle toward the Mexicans. At the present moment, It is our demand for drugs and our gun laws that are contributing to violence that is destabilizing that country. So if you really want to take moral obligation seriously, I don't mean that you shouldn't, but if you want to, then we really have to ask, why do the Afghans come first in the pecking order of moral obligations that we have? If you believe that Afghans should come first, then the question becomes, well, why is the continuation of war the best way to acquit that obligation? I mean, does the perpetuation of war actually benefit the Afghan people? I mean, that poor woman who was mutilated, if indeed that is a problem that we want to address, then why don't we allow Afghan women who feel themselves threatened to go to the nearest U.S. Army outpost or State Department outpost, and we'll grant them sanctuary and we'll bring them here where they won't be mutilated? Of course, you know and I know what would be the response to sort of bringing a quarter of a million or a half million Afghan women into this country. Oh. And indeed, if the perpetuation of war is the best way to acquit our obligation to the Afghan people, then what do you and I as citizens contribute? Because the fact is, the way we wage war today, the burden of service and sacrifice is imposed on 0.5% of the population, right? The other 99.5% of us do not serve. Moreover, the burden of paying for the war is imposed on others. We don't pay for the war. All these wars are being paid for basically by going ever deeper in debt. What I'm saying is, even if the perpetuation of war is the best way to fulfill our moral obligation to the Afghan people, and if that's so darned important, then should not we bear the burden? Should not we be sending our kids over there to serve? Should not we be paying either higher taxes or getting lower Social Security payments if this moral obligation is indeed all that important and pressing? So I do not take lightly the question of moral obligation. But quite frankly, and I don't mean this in an antagonistic way towards anybody in this room, it just kind of sticks in my craw that people say, oh yes, there's this great moral obligation, so let's send somebody else's kid over there to serve his fifth combat tour so that I can sit here in my little house and sort of have my conscience eased. That's not right. Is that a fair answer to the question which you actually didn't ask?
Well, and it's interesting because that was about to be my next question. There are a number of questions here that had to deal with humanitarian interests in Afghanistan and women's rights and that sort of thing. So I think you did a nice job of touching on that. In your book, you spend a lot of time talking about Vietnam and the lessons learned, and then you sort of come to the conclusion that they were unlearned or forgotten very quickly. I don't want to have you talk about it too long. We have maybe one more question after this, but what do you think has led to this amnesia about the lessons learned there?
Well, the argument I make in the book, and it was something that kind of surprised me a little bit. I'm a Vietnam era guy, and I'm one of these people who thinks that was the pivotal moment in American history. You know, before everything was X, and after Vietnam, everything was Y. And what struck me as I was working on the book is the extent to which that is a complete misperception and a vast overstatement of the impact of that war, especially on national security policy. I mean, fall of Saigon's 1975. By 1980, we elect Ronald Reagan, who, to put it mildly, had revisionist views about the war. 10 years after that, we're sending 500,000 troops to fight in the first Iraq war, and the so-called Vietnam syndrome vanishes? How did it happen so quickly that the so-called lessons of Vietnam were overturned? What I discovered, or at least what I argue, is that the reason the lessons of Vietnam were overturned is because people devoted to the Washington rules, people committed to the national security consensus, were intent on ensuring that the lessons that came out of Vietnam were lessons that were consistent with that consensus. And I try to illustrate that by talking about some study groups that were formed after Vietnam to assess its legacy. Study groups that reached conclusions that basically said, well, it's really nothing much to learn. So I think that's how Vietnam ended up not being the turning point that people like myself imagined that it would be.
I think this will be our last question. Again, there have been a number of comments on the question cards regarding the reception that your ideas might receive and amongst the public as well as politicians. I wonder if you might just take the last minute or so to reiterate your alternatives to the Credo and the Trinity that I think are in your book and make sense to me, at least.
Well, I mean, the alternative to the conviction that we can shape and transform the world is to focus on fulfilling our own stated aspirations, which are challenging, to put it mildly, and are not yet complete. Purpose of America is to be America. I don't myself view that as somehow a small or niggardly ambition. It's a vast ambition, and that's where we should, I think, focus our immediate attention. There is this tension in the tradition of American statecraft, an ongoing argument. To the extent that the United States has a mission to the world, should it perform that mission by imposing itself on the world or by serving as an exemplar? I am in the camp that says we can more effectively influence through example than through shoving freedom down somebody else's throat. And I think in support of that credo, then I would just advocate a far more modest military posture and greater restraint in the use of military power. It's not an argument for pacifism. It's not an argument for disarmament. It's an argument for realism. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you all for coming. We're out of time, but on behalf of the World Affairs Council and Books, Inc., I would like to thank Andrew Bacevich for providing us with his thoughts and insights. And I would like to remind you that Dr. Bacevich's book is available, courtesy of Books, Inc., and that he's agreed to stay and sign copies here on stage. So thanks again for coming.